This is a production of Cornell University.
All right.
Sure.
I'd like to call the meeting to order, please. It's 4:33 on December 3rd, and we have a quorum, barely, but we have 10 members. Do you want to call the roll for it?
Amani Allen. Joseph Anderson.
Here.
Andy Barrientos Gomez.
Here.
Christopher Barth.
Here.
Richard Bentzel.
Here.
Jim Krokodowicz.
Yes.
Shang Wan Chin.
One other.
Masa Haddad.
She won't be here.
She's travel delayed.
Yeah.
David Heiner.
Here.
Robert Howard.
Here.
Adam Howell.
Here.
Logan Kenny.
She won't be here.
Tomas Rick Newman.
We won't be here.
Ellis Lowe. Gavin Martin.
He's on his way.
Renata.
Mrs. Thomas.
He's out.
Jeff P.
Here.
Eli Thompson.
Here.
And Charles Van Lund.
Here.
Okay, thank you. First, we have any late additions for the agenda? Okay. Hearing none, let's go on to the approval of the minutes.
Before we approve the minutes, if I can, Bob, just
please.
A comment. I believe in the November meeting, Logan asked for the approval to be tabled. Her specific concerns when I spoke to her today had been that some of the detailed communication and, let's say, detail of the interactions had been missing. The Office of Assembly did update the minutes to reflect more detail, but after speaking with the OA, as well as reviewing the November minutes, we will move forward with the fact that the written minutes will be more of a general, broader document taken from the recordings. But if you did want the meat and potatoes, as it were, you would have to go to the audio. Therefore, all 3 minutes are set for approval today.
Okay, thank you for that. And just as an aside for context, our bylaws are silent as to what the minutes will or will not contain, but Robert's Rules of Order, which therefore prevails, says that the minutes need only contain motions which are passed or not passed and the votes on them. Absolutely no requirement for recording discussion. So I think it's fine that we try to capture some of the discussion, but it's not necessary for the minutes. Mm-hmm. Do I have a motion to approve the minutes? Jeff?
Mm-hmm. I motion to approve the minutes.
Sorry. I caught you in your multiple, okay.
Second.
Any objection? All those in favor of accepting the minutes? Opposed? Abstain? Okay, the motions are passed with no negatives, three abstentions. They are approved. Our next item is a resolution brought to us by Chris Barth on the Cornell Campus Circulator, and I believe this is on behalf of the Campus Infrastructure Committee, but correct me if I'm wrong.
Yeah, that's correct. So while we're getting our Zoom in, I do have a presentation that explains this resolution. Has anybody been able, by show of hands, to read the resolution in advance of this meeting? Okay, so most of us. What this resolution comes from is, as a shared governance member, the first time I heard about the Cornell Master Plan was last year, and then I started sitting in a variety of meetings that between the employee assembly and the university assembly, they kept talking about this thing called a circulator, and it was a very weird term that I had never heard before, which I do have a definition in my PowerPoint. Basically, it's like a closed point, you know, from point to point, major locations, kind of transit system. And it comes to find out that after sitting in these meetings, the main one is the campus planning committee. So it is like a committee body of the university assembly. I forget what the technical term is. It's like associate, but it's a group of the professionals on campus that make design decisions about how we use our land, what buildings do we rehab, where do we put new buildings. And one of the things on their list was the campus circulator as well. So when I dug into it, it was like since 2008, we've been talking in all of these committees and all of our reports, including the 2019 transportation study. That this circulator is something that everybody agrees that should get done, but it turns out it never has gotten done. It has not even really been started or looked at in too much detail other than conceptually. So with that in mind, at a Board of Trustees reception where they had us around, I was making the case for actually having more staff housing on campus to try to reduce our carbon footprint, be more sustainable, and those kind of things. And one of the Board of Trustees members said, well, I don't necessarily think that that is the issue. It's when the people get here, they can't get to where they're going in a timely fashion. Like a circulator again. And I was like, okay, well, now I've heard this term from a lot of different people, including the Board of Trustees. And I was like, well, what would I have to do to try to get a circulator going? And they said, write a resolution. So you're going to give me the homework right away. Like, I've never wrote a resolution before. I'm like, okay. And realistically, a resolution, in my own opinion, is we're making a recommendation and basically all collectively sending an email to the administration saying, we talked about this, we looked at this, we determined that this is somewhat of a priority, and we would like to see things happen related to it. The text of this resolution I specifically wrote without design decisions in mind. So this is really a let's just get started. There is a project that is here. We've been really talking about it. There's a lot of people that would be potentially involved. You know, our UA Campus Infrastructure Committee, the GPSA Transportation Committee. I do have a list of all the different ones, the CPC as well. And those committees are really where the people are going to help making the guide design decisions about what does this look like and what kind of technology are we using. But particularly, I do have sustainability in mind. And that's sweet. My name is Chris Bark. I'm a CIT desktop engineer, so I work for Central IT Services on campus. I'm on the University Assembly on the Campus Infrastructure Committee. I'm also the chair of that. I'm on the Campus Planning Committee as a liaison to the UA, and I'm on the Employee Assembly Campus Welfare Committee, which also covers transportation issues. So what is a circulator? A circulator is a bus transit that is short distance, circular, fixed route transit mode that takes riders around a specific area to major destinations. It may include streetcars, rubber tire trolleys, electric buses, or compressed natural gas buses. This is a definition from the Texas A&M Transportation Institute. Who will this affect? Everybody, but specifically students, faculty, staff, alumni, guests, and visitors. I just mentioned that the whole point of the resolution is sort of like a mission statement, a collection of all the info that is out there, and a please get started, somebody get assigned this project and get going on it. It does not go into detail what is it going to be made of, how are things going to run, what is going to change, but there are some things that we can infer from other information I'm about to show you. We're really just asking the administration to take this idea that just in the amount of meetings that I've been in, it hasn't been that expensive where they talk about the circulator. They probably could have just made it already. So how can it help? So this is where I wanted to talk about, just read through the resolution out loud. So this started with me actually working with the transportation office. I went to Bridget and Reed and said, this is this thing, how will we do this? Because what Pilar told me is, you just can't go around getting demands and having the president stamp it. You got to make sure that the people who are going to do the work are actually going to be on board with doing it. And one of the things I can let you know is when they were asked by the president what his transportation initiatives this year, the number two thing they said was the development of the campus circulator. So the abstract, and I'm not necessarily sure it is Yeah, vote of hands. Who wants to hear me read this out loud so we all hear it at the same time? Or should I just like stick to the highlights?
Highlights.
Yeah. Abstract. For the past 11 years, a Cornell campus circulator system of transportation has been under discussion as a way to improve access to many university functions and to address the continual challenges related to transportation and parking that Cornell uses days every day. We propose that this project become a priority for Cornell and be realized within the next period of 5 years. So even with transportation, they thought that that was a realistic timeline. They were like, probably something would be in proof of concept mode of having whatever the vehicles are in the schedules in 2 to 3 years, but then learning from what kind of good and not so unplanned changes happen and then make concrete changes. Marty Hatch, who had resigned from assemblies this year, was my co-sponsor. I have no idea how we handle that, but I still want a name on this. So I might be for that idea. There might be something official that I might need a co-sponsor or something. So this was identified in the 2008 master plan. This is also identified and touched upon related to the fact that we should, in the Cornell 2013 Climate Action Plan, reduce fossil fuel consumption, use mass transportation, and try to meet the goal of carbon neutrality in 2035. In 2015, there was a Game Farm Road Athletic Complex facilities master plan with the idea that a lot of the on-campus stadiums and things would sort of be moved behind East Hill Plaza, which there are soccer fields right now out there. But that whole development, the reason that is functionally stuck is because there's no way to really get to it easily for students. Which it was a funny conversation when I did hear the athletics department say, that's like too far away to go. And I said, are you guys like the best at running? Like, so but it's true. It's not like super well lit. It's like behind, you know, it's just not really prominent. So this would be something that could get people there in a safe way. Sort of the biggest one of all of these whereas clauses on line 32. Whereas the need for a campus circulator was identified in Cornell's 2018 parking optimization study as a way to reduce the reliance on TCAT large bus traffic through the center campus, to provide more frequent transit to more locations on campus, to increase connectivity and reduce the confusion inherent in current transportation options, to reduce the anxiety and challenges around the current parking proximity and destinations, to reduce the amount of car traffic on campus, to increase the use of existing perimeter parking, and to encourage the use of sustainable intra-campus mobility options around the campus. What isn't said in there is in the transportation study, they said we have adequate parking by like something, I should pick a real number, but I don't know it. So it's something like we have almost 1,000 plus parking spots on campus. The thing that we all feel, and even in the employees' priority survey, 141 employees, we took this poll on the EA out to everybody on as an employee. 141 of them want employee health and well-being as the number one priority for the employee assembly, and 140 of them want better parking and transportation. So as much as they care to live, they care to park. And those two things, I think, are tied directly into each other. It's like, my well-being is I don't have to go park here and wait 45 minutes to get here and leave at 6 a.m. to catch the right bus. Yeah, bye.
I just want to point out that you've got another 5 minutes, including discussion and a vote, if we can, because we've got a pretty full agenda.
Oh, well, then. So, vote.
Questions?
I don't want to be rude in cutting you off, but I do want to make sure we get through the agenda item.
The other good news is that we did get a drafted core value statement, which talks about creating respect for our natural environment and sustainability, as well as they were really happy that we were able to help Cornell University help New York City and New York State by working on some of the tunnel problems that they were having. So this is an example of if we came up with something really cool like Cornell, could it be piloted and go out to other SUNYs? I talked about this stuff about how it could help, including reducing the environmental impacts from private and individual transportation. So here is the first map from the Campus Circulator 2017. It is not the best map in the whole wide world because they use only black lines for everything. But what you can see here is this is Core Campus, and it is identifying that a circulator would go around here in Core Campus. One would come out to this side. Everything inside the purple lines is a 5-minute walk away, and then it comes out here to Balch. with the 2019 master plan study, they really looked at this. And they're talking about here on the side the changing and consolidation of different bus routes, but you'll notice that the maps together are very similar. They just broaden out where they're going. So Core Campus is one route. Then going out to East Hill Plaza is another, coming down here into Lower Campus. And Lower Campus is an interesting thing because the vet school calls everything that is not the vet school down campus. And that's because their whole universe is in this spot. So from here, we're basically downtown, and the vet school would never even come to this meeting. And this is what the solution that a circulator would be trying to figure out. What it can look like. I told you we're not in the design decisions, but here are examples of circulators. They're either smaller shuttle buses. They're either just big buses that run on a different route, but we do want to reduce the amount of buses. You know, this is not a bus depot, this is Cornell, and part of the master plan is respect that. The thing in the middle is Texas Southern University's fully autonomous circulator. I can't make any promises on that. We might have to get snow tires on this thing if we do get one of these things, but that was one of the challenges that I raised to the transportation department of why can't we dream big? And Cornell has different things on campus where there are initiatives trying to look at this and how to make them practically work across the university. Sustainability is something that I had in mind, so much so that I put it five times in the clauses of the circulator draft of the week, where the partnership between TCAT. One of the things I learned too is that only first-year students have access to free TCAT, and that just seems like why would we not want to have everybody riding on this if we're really trying to get to our sustainability goals. But one of our campus infrastructure committee members, Jacob, did say, if you sort of like touch and mess with these things, how is it going to affect the rest of TCAT Zone 1? Because now we're on the sort of loop and the route sort of changed and some of the access to Ithaca itself is like very important for everybody else. Which I was like, good call, Jacob. The reason we're discussing this is to pick up those things and put them into a finalized draft that hopefully, once we get that, here's everybody that will be doing the work. Cornell Transportation Department, TCAT affiliates, the Campus Planning Committee, all of us and all of our affiliated different groups. This is the idea. Is on 11/15, I sent an email to all the executive committees with the help of the Office of Assembly, sent to you, Gina, and said, here's my pitch. This is where we are. I want this to just be in front of you so that the next time we can like meet and I can come and give this kind of a presentation to talk about why this is, why I think we need it, and build some more support. With the idea that after we collect the feedback and try to add, hopefully not more pages, but you know, some good extra pages or information to this, because everybody's constituency has its own things. With the idea that before this break, we've all heard of it, we can go home and think about it, and then as the next term shows up, we hopefully can all get together to just pass this draft as with the competing information. It is in the Employee Assembly Campus Welfare Committee right now, with the idea that they would be passing the same thing. So questions, thoughts, feedback, the discussion.
Thank you, Chris. I think this is a great idea. It's actually part of our graduate professional community initiative. It's a 5-year strategic plan for the graduate professional students. So I don't think you're going to have any issue getting this through the GTSA. My one question is, I think in order to strengthen the resolution, which I think is already strong, is have you looked at our peer institutions and see what they have available? I know Princeton has a shuttle that is available for students for free of charge, but I'm not sure if there's other institutions. I think that would only support the resolution to know that everyone else is doing it. Always.
Thanks for that feedback. I have not. I figured. Everybody had looked at that, but I agree that to strengthen it and looking at our peers always helps make the case. So I think finding that information would be really good. Thanks, good suggestion.
David?
So when I started at Cornell back in 2008, there was a campus circulator. And can you tell me what the difference between what you're trying to propose versus what was once available and then done away with in place of the 82? How that was different?
No. I don't have any answers about what it looked like before.
I will say that the one before was horribly managed. It was never on time, and it often would take 45 minutes for it to show up. So, I don't suppose there is more going back to 2008. If it runs every 5 to 10 minutes, that would be great. That's my 2 cents.
Richard?
So, actually, I have two questions. I mean, they're really just factual questions. now the TCAT bus runs from downtown, for example, filled with kids, drops them on campus. You're going to need transfer points between your circulator and TCAT buses. So that's the first question. Obviously, you've thought about it, but I'd like to hear about it. The other is the circulator. How about late at night? You know, the buses run late at night, the TCAT. Are you going to run the circulator late at night as well, or is there going to be a transfer load?
So, great questions. Those are design decisions. I would basically say related to that, because I thought about it too. I was like, hey, it's an off snow day. Like, and there would still be people on campus who are the mission critical employees, faculty, and staff that need to get around. What happens to it on a snow day? Those would all be things that would need to be addressed by the design process and the iterations. Like, for instance, I have heard that Route 10 has changed recently, and some people feel it's a great improvement, and it's running, I think that's down from the Fall Creek area up on the campus. Mm-hmm. And other people are like, by the time the bus gets from there to there, it's filled with a whole bunch of people. And so now you end up actually, even though they're running more, they're more full. So those are kind of the considerations that I think along with what David said is, what were the lessons learned? And when the group of people start looking at that, that would be some of the very first things that they would need to take a look at is what happened last time, and then where is there going to be pain points. There is, I can share this part of the PowerPoint real quick with you. I guess what I would say is I'm not looking for a vote on this today. Like, it's sometime next year would be fine, and mostly in the UA and most of the other assemblies, you sort of introduce the topic and then you sit on it before you talk about it later on. To speak to your point, Richard, about where are these places, I can't zoom in, but these stars that are here, here, and here are defined as hubs. Mm-hmm. But I have the question of what is a hub? Like, is that, what does a hub have that, you know, just a bus stop does not have? So I think that is a spot where you would connect to, we need more definition around when I'm at a hub, where do I go?
Okay. Thank you, Chris. I think given the time and the fullness of the agenda, we'll move on, particularly since you're not asking for a vote. Presumably, the Campus Infrastructure Committee will continue to discuss this, so any UA member can participate in that as well.
That is correct. Our next meeting is tomorrow at 4 p.m., so if you get really pumped up and come and meet us in Wild 221. If you do have any other thoughts, feedbacks, or considerations, because I know we all process information at different speeds, and sometimes you need someone to read some things. KB599 is my email address, and I will definitely be very interested in your feedback. So thank you for your time today.
And it's on the box as well if you don't have a hard copy or lose a hard copy.
We've got three more agenda items, or four, reports from the three committees, about 20 minutes each, but for the Campus Infrastructure Committee, which is Chris again, Caroline Levine has also asked to talk, and so there's a lot to cover here. I just want to get a sense from campus welfare and campus CJC whether you want full 20 minutes before we.
I don't think so.
Okay. So if we run a little over here, you're okay?
Yeah.
Okay. Just want to make sure. So with that, Chris, why don't you give a report on the Campus Infrastructure Committee, and then Carolyn Levine, who's chair of the English department, has asked to talk to us about divestment from fossil fuels as well.
Sure. So the circulator you just heard about, really wanted to be a CPC thing, but because they're not organized where they feel comfortable voting, I was working with them and said, I'll at least go this way with it, and hopefully you can support it. Another topic that has been big is divestment. Specifically the divestment of fossil fuels. So Cornell and its endowment has this portfolio. I've only been able to find out that in an article in 2015, Beth Garrett, the president at the time, did say it's something like point with 10 zeros and 1% of Cornell's holdings, but it translated, at least as far as the news article goes, to $25 million. Which is a lot of money depending on where you are in the university, I can say for sure. I was a person who particularly was not interested in the divestment conversation, but I decided to like try to step aside from it and say, if I was really interested, the reason why I was not exactly interested is in 2015-16, all the assemblies together passed a divestment resolution, and it went to the Board of Trustees, and the Board of Trustees said, you know, this looks really good and smart, but not something we're really ready to do. So here's a set of criteria that you need to address the next time you're going to make a set of resolutions. And it comes with the things of if only a certain amount, if not all assemblies pass the same divestment resolution, you can go to the president's office and then whatever happens after that, and then that is the end of that discussion. But if all of the assemblies pass the divestment resolution, it goes to the Board of Trustees, but there are these criteria that they set out that you explicitly have to show that there's injurious harm, moral reprehensiveness by the actors in the companies of the portfolio. Because the company portfolio information is like pretty well guarded. It's not easy to go and find. Yeah. So after doing some homework and looking at all the things that were out there, we had some good advocates. The students and the faculty really, really want the divestment. They just see it as like a person is drowning in their sin, and you know, you can help them, but you're just not going to go and do that. It feels that way emotionally, I think, for us. Like, this is an imperative. We're a science-based place. We know that this is happening, and since the 60s, they've been like slow playing the fossil fuels, I guess. So Caroline, who is really good with words as a Cornell English chair of the English department, said, you know, it would be really cool if we just like took a shot at trying to answer this new criteria that they set out with, which I think is like a reasonable thing to say, is that, hey, it's been a, you know, 3 years, but a lot of new information has come out, and no one yet has really approached this subject, though I do know the student assembly is writing and working on a resolution itself, and I heard just today that the faculty senate is starting to like think about it. But the big idea is not all the trustees are opposed to it, as we've heard through different side conversations, as well as Bob Harrison being out on Hoy Plaza and taking the concerns right out of the hands of the petitions and listening to the students. So it, they know it's a topic that we're out there, but we want to try to figure out how can we meet the criteria. And we acknowledge that this is an issue that is not sure, you know, it's a complicated thing. Even as someone who supports it, I don't know necessarily how I feel as an employee in the business of the university and how it all works yet, but I do support it. So Caroline offered to come in today and give an update about a memo or a letter that we have been drafting to the Board of Trustees and the administration about where we are now, what we know about what's happened in the last 3 years, as well as what our peer institutions are doing in trying to make the case. So,
Caroline, welcome.
Thank you so much, and thanks for having me here. Chris laid out nicely the kind of conversation that we've been having. Because the trustees didn't say no, absolutely not, never, they said, you haven't made the case that we need to hear, which is that we will divest from companies that meet the following criteria. And when we looked at those criteria, we thought, yeah, fossil fuels meet these criteria. We have the knowledge here to make that case. I myself have been an environmentalist and worked in environmental humanities for a long time, but I didn't know where I stood on divestment, but doing the homework has really persuaded me it's well worth doing, and none of the, I keep hearing arguments against it, none of them have yet to topple my sense that this is really worth doing, that Cornell should do it. So I've been trying to think it through with all of the counter arguments and to draft with our committee pretty long, but well-supported, well-substantiated case for how divestment meets the criteria that the trustees have brought forward. So be happy to take questions. The goal would be that the CIC would put forward a resolution that, and that all five assemblies would vote for something similar, and that it would then go before the trustees this year. I think things often move slowly in big institutions, but climate change is not moving slowly. So it feels more urgent, especially with the news out just this past week about how we're hitting the tipping points faster even than scientists had thought we were. So that's why there's more urgency to this than I think normally we might think about with institutional.
Before we handle questions, let me just add that you've drafted what I consider a really fine white paper. We should probably share that with the members, partly for information, but also for potential input. your plan is to take it back to the campus infrastructure committee. My hope, I tend to support it, but my hope would be that it would come back to the full assembly at our next meeting, which is end of January. We can debate and discuss it then, perhaps for a February vote. And I think that's more or less on time with what the Faculty Senate might do if they do anything, and what the student undergraduate assembly would be doing. I'm not sure about the other assemblies. But again, in order to have any real power, it has to move through all five assemblies in comparable form. So, Richard.
So, some technical questions, or not technical, but how you put this together. One is that, you know, you're not going to divest all at once. There's combined, you're going to be gradual. So you want an intake. And just, okay, so you've already bought that. The second is the nature of, you know, because these are companies, and, you know, you're Exxon has just acres, maybe square miles of solar. So there are a lot of companies in Exxon you're going to invest. But some of them are really mixed. So how are you going to decide, you know, any case? I mean, this is any taint of fossil fuels and you divest, or is it a proportion? Are you going to do that? The second is all the subsidiary companies. Mm. I mean, Caterpillar's tractor for open pit mining, right? That's what they do. You know, are you going to divest them? So the question is really the technical question of who's in, who's out. Mm-hmm.
The research that we have shows that I think it's 20 companies are responsible for, well, I forgot the exact number, but 70% of carbon emissions come from fossil fuel. And of those 20 companies are responsible for something like 80% of the total. Those are all big companies like Exxon, Shell, Chevron, BP. And what we learned also is that although they talk about their acres and acres of solar, none of them have actually invested in renewables the way that they might have or could have, and are instead planning to dig and mine further now. And it's that it's really urgent to stop, to make sure that they don't continue to mine. And their reserves, we could use those up supposedly, we'd still be setting up our carbon emissions, but if we continue to mine and dig, we're really in danger. So what would put the pressure on those 20 companies to say, okay, we're going to stop our plans to keep mining and digging? And those are the companies we're trying to target.
So you would name them?
Yes, they are named. Yes.
Yes.
So the student assembly is collaborating with the graduate professional student assembly to write a resolution. I think it's been written already. I know that you mentioned that you're creating a report. Would it be okay to share that information with this, right, with people writing the resolution?
Absolutely.
Can I put them in contact with you to see
please.
If you're talking about the same things or not?
Yes, definitely. So I sent it via our undergrad rep on the CIC, but I'm not sure how widely it's circulating. I'm happy to give it, and again, for feedback as well as for informational purposes.
Is there any reason we shouldn't put that on the University Assembly website?
It's still in a draft form, so I think what is probably the most prudent is I will work with the Office of Assembly to take it and send it to all the University Assembly members. I do have it here.
Labeled as a draft.
I'm going to read it to you. And it's like super impressive to read a Cornell English professor's English paper, right? You know, on this stuff. And the update on the facts is currently 90 corporations are responsible for 2/3 of all the greenhouse gas emissions caused by human activity. Among these, just 8 energy companies account for 20% of world carbon emissions. BP, Exxon, Royal Dutch Shell, and Chevron are on the list. Even the thing about a resolution, to be honest, is like somewhat unapprehensive, even as someone who supports this, because we did a resolution as a university before, and we sort of got a really big speed bump, I guess, to be very nice about it. And trying to have the same conversation in a different way is something that I am sort of interested in, which is why I like the memo. But I do think, you know, the whole idea that this took off was that the student assembly is going to have something, and we're working in parallel with what our case is to try to meet the criteria, and if we can take our memo and attach it to their resolutions, and then as well in the university assembly take up and promote as well a resolution that supports their resolutions, then that is something that sort of just makes sense to me. But if you were like, Chris, draft your own resolution as the CSE chair member to fight for this, I'm still in like an awkward spot with that, because I just, you know, the Faculty Senate, and I have this all actually sitting here so I can show it to you shortly. The Faculty Senate made the financial case. Like, everybody, when I thought about this and I really got high on the horse of like, we're going to have to do a Cornell thesis on this whole thing, and it turns out that everybody really did do a Cornell thesis on this whole thing. So, to quickly give everybody, the standards that we're supposed to meet is a company's inactions or actions are morally reprehensible, the divestiture will likely have a meaningful impact toward correcting the specified harm and will not result in disproportionate offsetting of societal consequences, and the company contributes to harm so great that it would be inconsistent with the goals and principles of the university. And I went through the homework, and I can sum this all here. You know, this is the essay saying the best from Cole. They only wanted Cole, and they were told no. All of the Ivy Leagues don't want to do this. So if you look at the divestment report, so there's something there that's more to it. But the Faculty Senate wrote a whole report of how this is going to financially impact and affect us, and what knowing with whatever holdings that they sort of could glean out of, because the investment office is not necessarily straightforward about posting which percentage of what. And it basically comes down to there will be no significant change to the endowment at all if we get rid of these things. And that's the kind of thing that personally, though I support this effort, it was like, how can I get you to listen to me? And I potentially, that's why this is the best part, I think, is having someone that is engaged, wants to try to engage the Board of Trustees on their own terms and give this a different shot. So that's just where...
We do think that possibly... We have actual information about this, but speculatively, certainly, we think that the trustees feel strongly that they know the investments, and we shouldn't lecture them on the financials.
Right.
We have actually also found a lot of information that suggests, including the University of California system recently divesting it, that the financials are not looking good for fossil fuels anyway. But in other words, we did not, in our report, we do not focus. The last time in 2015, that was where the focus is. This time it's much more on the goals and principles of the university and injurious harm, a little bit about the payments.
I might just add that in addition to taking on the trustees with the criterion they've given, which is the moral reprehensibility and all, I think it's reasonable for the assembly to consider saying that there are other things these trustees should be considering. We don't want to be the last university to divest. University of California system already has divested. It makes sense, at least to me, to set a trajectory so we're not the last people there if we want to be seen as a green, environmentally leading university. Yeah.
Well, first of all, thank you for all your efforts. Is it your intent to file a resolution and have it passed through the committee and within the university assembly? I hope so. And from the employee assembly standpoint, if that's a trajectory you're on, I would love to carry the similar version from the employee assembly. I think, regardless of what has been done in the past, it's paramount to keep trying. However one wants to know the context of the method in which we try, it's of vital importance. So I'm actually thinking of a member of the committee, so I the letter, the paper was excellent, and I loved it.
Charlie?
I'm trying to get my head around the grad students and the undergraduate doing something. Your committee's doing something. You have a white paper. Something's going to show up in the Senate next week. At some point, there'll be one resolution. When's that going to be? And is the Senate thing going to be simply the white paper, heads up, a resolution is coming your way?
Good question. We have a proposal for you, actually. I wanted to ask you what you think, which is to say that the resolution could be extremely brief. A one sentence, be it resolved that Cornell divest from fossil fuels, coal, oil, and natural gas, and then follow that with the white paper, the rationale for the decision, rather than breaking it into whereases and, you know, that just seems clunkier than it would be otherwise. So that the resolution would be, and I don't know formally how that looks to you in terms of parliamentary procedure.
Yeah, I don't think we really know yet, Charlie. Like, we have been waiting to see what the SA is. Like, they are the ones that convinced me, like, hey, this is still an important thing. I also heard on the radio story that Ithaca College knows that students are thinking about the best when they're enrolling in universities itself. And so, similar to the circulator, who goes first? How does it all work together? Do we all have to pass the same language? What is the timing of these things? And it's even more confusing because we have this criteria that no one has ever tried to address yet since they laid it out. So I think it was see what the SA, now that we know that's the GPSA we're working on, you know, from the student side, what do they have? We knew that this was going to be valuable information, whether we created it in a resolution or we just sent it as an update, because that was where, remember, I was the no, and now I'm a yes, maybe, I don't know, I guess, according to what Adam heard me say, which is true. So it's like, I feel like we're in a spot where we're not, the intention, because resolutions make sense out of the assemblies, is something that I think we all naturally want to go to, and supporting the ones that are coming from the students any way that we can makes sense to us. Who, how, and when does it come out of the UA is something that at least I haven't figured out yet.
I think the point Richard brings up, like, what does it actually mean to divest? How do you go down this list of companies, and either you're in or you're out? And I think people are going to want to see what the rules are, because if you're going to say, you know, cite some core value. Let's see it in action. Here's your core value. You apply it to this company. We'd like to. I think you want to see that. If this is general, I don't think it's going to. I worry about the force of it if it isn't kind of specific.
And what I understand is that divestment resolutions are often, or divestment commitments to divest often do take a number of years, and so a university will say we will fully divest from coal, oil, and fuel over the next 10 years, for example. And that allows people to actually figure out all the details and all the logistics. Is it important for us to coordinate with the GPSA and the SA language? Or
I just think, like, you know, we only have, like, 1 week, though. I was going to say, we're working on this. Here are the open questions, you know, like Rich's point. How do we make it, you say, we'd like to address the trustees on your own terms. Here is what they laid out. Do you have any ideas about that? I'll just sort of frame it as a, hey, what do you think about this?
And not have the resolution yet.
Oh, no.
Okay.
Richard?
Yeah, just a follow-up on that. You name the companies. One of the questions is going to be, okay, so they divest in Exxon. They're going to invest in Apache. The point is, they'll take oil and gas companies that are not on the list and just move the money over. So you don't have to worry about, you know, questions like that. You could make the companies morally responsible in some way, but then you've got to have an argument why they're morally responsible and Apache is not. It's I worry about your criteria and the fit with this broader thing. I can just see the portfolio manager saying 20% has to be in oil and gas, or whatever the percentage is that they do. And they just shift the funds. So,
what is it?
Our criteria, Richard, what do you mean? Because this is the Board of Trustees criteria.
Yeah.
Whatever their manager is. I mean, the traditional thing is that you weight the sectors as they, their proportions of the economy. And that's it. That's like, you know, buying the standard resource or something. If you were doing that and you had a you had a resolution that just said these 20 companies, then they just shift to companies that are on the list and maintain it. I don't know what Cordell's investment policy is. I'm just saying, you know, one of the big portfolio managers, that's what they would do. But that would be a possible objection, you know, that you might want to provide for something.
I think, if I can go ahead, please. I think the resolution would be to divest fully from coal, oil, and gas over a certain period of time, let's say 10 years. That's all of those companies. But the moral reprehensibility we've attached to this list of the big eight and shown how they've been, partly because the research is there, shown how they've been complicit with the increase in fossil fuel use. So it's less that those are the only companies we would divest from, and more that we can see where the reprehensibility lies. If that.
David?
So I have two comments. With every scientist out there saying that climate change is a real concern, that they keep on speeding up the clock, is 10 years too long to wait to divest? You don't have to answer that now. It just feels like 10 years is a long time to go through the process. My second point is how do you propose handling future companies that are going to release IPOs in the oil and gas industry? And I bring that up because there's a Saudi Arabian company that makes all of these other companies look like peanuts compared to their size. I mean, it's huge. And they're getting ready, or they haven't already, released an IPO worth trillions of dollars. And how do we handle that?
Well, two things. One, the commitment to divest, let's say over 10 years, might seem like a long time, but the message that gets sent is immediate, which is to say reputable institutions are turning their backs on fossil fuels, and so that can have a huge impact even if it's not the divestment itself. And the other is that IPOs are not the only problem here, because Cornell has a fair number of investments in private offerings, so we really do want it to be, whatever they're from, all coal, oil, and gas.
Just really briefly, you know, there's a lot of very interesting detailed kind of process arguments and things like that, or you know, nuances here. And one of the reasons why I haven't written anything for the employee assembly is because the students are working on their version. Has there ever been a thought of doing something by conference with all of the assemblies, which is a thing in you know, professional legislatures where representatives from all the assemblies could be the heads, the chairs, whatever, meet and taking these questions and solutions from the various assemblies and groups, come up with a unified statement? Because one thing that concerns me is that there's going to be vastly different versions of this coming from different places in different forms with different supporting documentation attached. And it's going to give the Board of Trustees, I'm not saying an out, I'm not saying that they're working for them or anything like that, but a reason to say that the message is very disjointed and ununified.
Right.
Should we not have representatives from each of the constituent assemblies together to write something unified that we all pass in concert, you know, taking feedback and then marking it up with a bill by or with a resolution by conference? It's an overall process concern of mine, and I don't know if that's ever been done, but I think it's something that should be considered because there's different things in different versions coming out at different times, and I think that can undercut the overall.
I think that's an excellent idea. It has not been done as far as I'm aware. It doesn't mean it hasn't, but we're in an unusual situation because the trustees have set up this rule that we all five have to have the same resolution or else they're not going to talk to us. So that's an unusual situation. John?
Yeah, I would be hesitant to do something of that sort, mainly because from the student assembly side, the student assembly is just representative of the student body. In fact, there are far better champions from the undergraduate community that press a far more intense, immediate agenda of divestment than a 10-year process. There are students that want divestment now and have been asking for divestment now for years and years and years. And so fundamentally, I would be uncomfortable with any conference because we know that the Student Assembly will always propose the most immediate, most pressing, and most now resolution. And that's something that I will honor as the president of my assembly, and I think something that the Student Assembly says really important. I think as the youngest people in shared governance overall, this is not a 10-year issue, this is a now issue. And I can only say that, you know, whether or not they are the, I don't know if they, when I read the protocol, it just says resolution. It doesn't say exact copies of resolutions, but a resolution is with the generalized sentiment that is exactly the same. So if it's all coal, oil, and gas, Student Assembly says let's divest now, and you, the University Assembly, let's divest in a 5-year, 10-year process, the Board of Trustees will consider all of those on a on their own playing field with the weighting of the recommendations that the Student Assembly said now. UA, here's what they all said, and they will make that decision fundamentally at the end of the day. We can only inform them on it. A conference, I think, only serves to potentially undermine a quick, a more rapid divestment and pigeonholes us, essentially, in my opinion. But, you know.
Yes.
Is it possible for, I mean, what I would like to do is to coordinate the language to whatever the Student Assembly is doing. Mm-hmm. I mean, that is to say the resolution does not have to be, you know, we're just a little committee and we're trying to, so we'd like to coordinate it just so that it feels very powerful.
Yeah.
So could we do that?
Yeah, 100%. Oh, okay. I know the people who work on it.
I don't think anybody was saying that the verbiage had to be something that is contrary to what the Student Assembly is doing. I think that the idea being that we don't give anybody the ability to undercut anyone's argument, you know, if it was together, and I wouldn't have any problem with immediacy in the language. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, that's just my thoughts on it.
Chris.
Arguably, the UA is the conference because it's five of us from each of all different parts. Mm-hmm. And I will also, without having any idea that this is true, argue that the UA's resolution would be the strongest because we are all five parts getting together and saying it. That is something that I think we would all have to work together to proceed as far as seeing how this goes. What comes to from the SA and the GPSA, we look at it at the UA and have a debate about that resolution as well. You know, however that gets introduced or brought in the formalness of it. And then, you know, try to stay within probably a 85% scope of the same thing. But just like with the circulator, if there's some reason that there's something that we don't know, we add into it that way and then move along those lines. Because just the things that Richard and Charlie have brought up today, as well as David, are things that help ultimately strengthen the case, but it will be potentially work that the UA has to do together on this, because once the, you know, the CIC potentially is going to get the resolution and then decide if we should take it from the CIC and vote on it and bring it to the UA, which seems like something that we can, we're likely to do, I guess I would say that. And then it's us, for us to craft it. And but there is a balance too of the, you know, the students definitely feel, and I can, you know, look, the faculty members, if we can do this right now, Caroline, like, let's do it. Like, I will hit the button, I will be the first one in line. So I do think we are working and can work together, and I think, Adam, you were right that it is important that we don't mix the message as much as possible, because any outs that we give anybody is like, I don't think they're going to scrutinize and be like, hey, you said the and you meant at, but I think just being consistent and clear about it.
Okay. That's a useful discussion. Thank you, Caroline. I think we'll move on for the agenda. Thank you very much for coming. That would be great. I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. With that, we'll move on to the Campus Welfare Committee and David. Something less controversial.
Yeah.
Totally not controversial.
So bad, though.
Totally not controversial.
Oh, no.
We could throw in tobacco companies as
investment. I think they're already invested in it.
I don't know.
Nicotine.
So my update is relatively brief in the terms that we've concluded the nicotine use survey that's taken three, four, five, I don't know how many years to get out. so it's finally done. It's out. And I've got some results, and I've broken it down by, you know, the student population, the employee population, and the faculty and research population. So first I would like to talk about the responses. This looks really promising. Students were by far the largest responders in terms of who responded to the survey. Staff were second, and faculty and RTE were third. There's a small other group who just chose not to answer who they were. But when we look at the population in terms of their response rate, faculty were by far the largest group. Which I'm not sure that I'm fully shocked by, but they're the smallest group and they have a pretty good response rate. So this is where it starts getting interesting. It's no shock that we're an educated institution. We probably do not have a large smoking population. And we can see that based on this response rate. Most people have either never smoked or haven't smoked in the last 30 days. Kudos to the Cornell population for being healthy. And then also the same trend for electronic nicotine use products. Where it gets really interesting is the perception of nicotine use. And you can see that the perception is all over the board. And there's been a lot of discussion about why this is. People smoking outside of buildings, people walking down a sidewalk and seeing somebody smoke. So the perception is that people smoke on a regular basis. And that trend is pretty consistent throughout everyone.
We're ready.
And the same trend is for smokeless tobacco products as well.
Oh, right, okay. I'm exposed.
So this is as people walk through campus, how often they're exposed to it. It's a nice little bell curve. Though it doesn't show that anybody is often exposed to secondhand smoke or aerosol vapors. People are generally concerned about secondhand smoke. Not shocking, everyone should be. Same with, let's see, did I do that wrong? Exposed to secondhand tobacco smoke. Okay, so I didn't update the title on this, but this should be for. That's right. For others. So
right.
People are
concerned for others.
Yeah, concerned for others. Moving on to aerosol vapors.
Right.
People. Same type of trend.
Yeah.
So this is the one that I did not take the title for. This should be for others as well. Same type of trend. So this one is if Cornell were to be a tobacco or nicotine free campus, would they have been excited to come to Cornell? Would they have looked elsewhere? I actually think this was a really poorly worded question, and that's my bad. That was pointed out after we launched the survey. Because I don't know, could mean it didn't really matter to them. I don't know. I mean, when I came to Cornell, I wasn't looking at whether or not it was a smoke-free campus. I was just happy to come to Cornell. So I question whether or not this actually proves anything.
That specific page?
Yeah.
Okay.
Other than
the whole thing.
Yeah. Just wanted to make sure.
Should we do it again?
No, no.
So this is the one we're all excited to see, and this is whether or not people would be in favor of going to a smoke-free or nicotine-free campus. If we look at somewhat agree, strongly agree, every group would be in support of that. In terms of this type of group.
Surprisingly similar distributions across the communities.
Yeah, I had hoped, well, not hoped. I'm happy to see that, you know, everyone's kind of thinking the same thing. Mm-hmm. They are all in agreement.
Is that the end of this one?
There's more.
Sorry. So there also was a large open-ended text responses, and after reading them, I got tired of reading them, so I just took all of the comments and threw it into a Wordle to see if we could get some sort of common words or phrases. You can see free.
Free.
There's also bad.
I really like that, because free comes up. I read the comments too. And so there's tobacco free.
Right.
And then there were a whole bunch of, you know, I want to be free. You know?
Right.
And so you free there just it stands in for
I mean, it has to be tobacco free.
Yeah.
So
I've read a lot of the open ended comments, but a lot of it is talking about walking through campus free of nicotine or smoke or being free to be able to breathe the clean air outside, that kind of stuff. So that's a lot of what was talked about in the survey open-ended responses. In terms of our online discussion, I'm not sure the same sentiment was had. There is a lot of discussion about just enforcing the current rules about the 25-foot barrier between buildings. There's some discussion about moving the cigarette butt cans away from the doors to a smoking area. And I would say that was probably about two-thirds of those comments. Where this does show ban a lot and smoke and, you know, people, reading the comments really did kind of paint a different picture. At least from my reading and going cross-eyed and falling asleep and whatnot. So from that, I'd like to open it up to discussion, comments, where we would like to go next. I'll be honest, the people who have said they wanted to be on the committee have been relatively non-existent in terms of showing up to the committee meetings. So there's been a lot of outside help. Ted, who's from Tobacco Free Tompkins, has been, I think you've been at almost every meeting, haven't you?
Many of them.
Yeah. And he's been a great voice in terms of, you know, validating what these trends show, in terms of the national take or survey results versus, you know, what we've produced. And when I first showed Ted these results, he was like, yeah, that's not shocking. It's the same trend as the national surveys that are done. So, and I've had people from labor relations, UAW, campus life.
So you are getting feedback and assistance. It's not just...
Right.
But officials see...
You don't have a functioning committee, but...
Right.
So this is where I think the overall UA needs to kind of step in, have some guidance. Where do we want to go forward as a UA as a whole?
Yeah.
Chris.
We did talk about this at the Employee Welfare Committee today from the EA, and I'll reiterate similar thoughts. It does seem to show that most people are not smoking, and most people think a lot of people are smoking. I would attribute that to things like you see it in TV and in the movies, and even if you just see it once, you can really easily think, like, hey, there's a lot of smoking going on. I'm with you in the comments online on our faculty forums. Thanks, Charlie. When you go and read through them, everybody is really concerned about the smoking police and ensuring the rules. And what I said is that smoking is an addiction. These are people. My wife is a smoker, and she loves smoking almost as much as she loves me. And it is a thing that I have an annual conversation with her, and I only have once a year. Is, hey, your brain was hijacked by this chemical, even though you made this choice to do it, and you love it, and you identify with it, and it's a difficult thing. And what I think is really going to be my take of this is the data shows we should work toward a smoke ban of some kind, but not where someone's going to come and put you in handcuffs or give you a ticket or slap, because the people that are going to be penalized are the people that have the largest challenge. They really, what we're trying to encourage is a change in behavior, not in trying. And if my wife got a $50 ticket for smoking, she would not smoke and buy cigarettes for 1 week, then go buy a lot and smoke twice as much in the same spot just to be like, you can't tell me what to do. I am like a person in America. So what at SUNY Albany, when they did this, and they banned it on campus last year, right before they were about to do it, the union workers did throw up a flag and said, we don't have enough secession aid, we don't have enough information about how we're going to be able to help people. Specifically, too, on Cornell campus, there is not a place that I could, another guy on the circulator, go somewhere that is awesome to get away from smoking here on campus. Like, there's no just across the street. Like, we're all in New York State in some sense, and what we would really need to do, and in the comments too, is like some universities went banned, they took away the urns, and so now there's cigarette butts all over the campus. And so like now you got rid of one thing, but you have another problem. But there are proactive ideas about making sure we highlight through our health plans and the things that we have as well, providing more support, however financially or campaign-wise. But then like even Wegmans has a smoking hut, which is sort of like a bust out for smokers, and ideally, you know, spending a lot of money to give people a place to smoke doesn't seem like the best use of university dollars, but with an empathetic view into trying to help our loved ones live longer and deal with something that a lot of us can't directly relate with because we're not addicted to this chemical that makes us want to have it no matter what, starting the idea that, hey, we did take a survey. It's not a perfect survey. It didn't get everybody's answers, but we have the data that we can move forward as an assembly to start making recommendations of, we would like a smoking ban, and here are the things that we think would be a part of that. Because what happened with Albany was they banned smoking, and all the people who did not respect the initial 35-foot rule finally did start respecting the 35-foot rule, but they're technically banned. So it's like they paid attention, but they still had this thing that they had to do.
Let me suggest, since we got about 20 minutes, that we carry another 4 or 5 minutes for this, and we're not going to resolve where to go. But there are several issues, one of which is we have the study. It looks very interesting. I think you've done an incredible job of pulling the data together, and I think we should share those with the communities as quickly as we can, right, as opposed to holding on to them.
Mm-hmm.
People
agree
with that. Beyond that, we need to think about what we do with them and whether we want to recommend a ban and what that might look like. And that's going to take some time, and your committee is not fully functional for that. So we need to think about it. But I would suggest we at least move forward with letting people know what the results are quickly. Yes?
Just quickly, just to respond, Chris, regarding the enforcement, there is nobody, I mean, as much as we'd like to see people getting caught, nobody that I've experienced has people getting tickets. City of Ithaca does issue citations just like a traffic ticket, but they don't do it very often. And so that's a law, but other campuses, Albany, I know when I was at SUNY Albany back in September, I see that they have sort of periodic stations where people can smoke, and it says this is a smoking place. They have a hut in that, not a hut, but just a butt receptacle. So But so really, that idea of getting a ticket doesn't exist. I mean, it really doesn't exist. And the other thing that I think is important to remember is that the question on the survey says a 2 to 3 year process. And so, you know, in my mind, what that means is that a committee is formed by the president so that it's got credibility. And everybody, and this is something that David and I have talked about, everybody on the committee has an idea of what the comments say, and how they work through the policy, and how they're going to promote it, and how people are going to deal with it, and what the cessation resources have to be, and all of those things over a period of time, so that all these issues have at least been addressed in some manner, and there is something has been said about it. And then there is the promotional time, so, you know, the best practices that you actually have a prohibition ban go into effect in January, so you have the entire fall semester to promote and get people ready. So it's a process. When you guys were going through the divestment, it's like you can throw tobacco ban into every place that you said divestment. Yeah. It's a process. Everybody else is going to do it. We don't want to be the last one. There's sustainability issues. Everything fits into there. It's the same thing. It's a process. The idea is, in my mind, this is like the greatest preventive that we can do, because if you don't do it now, in 10 years, you're going to say, why didn't we do it 10 years ago? So that now, 10 years after, it will, you know, you'll have gone through 2.5 generations of students, and it will now become, it will now, after 10 years, be the social norm. It will be the norm, and then that's when it really takes effect. Thanks.
We should spend just another minute on this, because we need to get to the Campus Welfare Committee, but Charlie, quick brief.
I don't think we can just follow all the comments and the survey over the wall and say, you deal with it. I think we really have to digest it ourselves. I think every single comment has to be read, and I think people, we have to distill out from all those comments the essence of what they're saying. And I would recommend the approach of writing a charge. In other words, if you decide to say, we recommend that there be some kind of ban, and now here, and give people some guidance. And these are the things you've got to consider to do that. And you know, things like, you know, I'm free, or you can't enforce the rules, or I have asthma. We have to really distill out from those comments the key things, so that the recipient of our message doesn't start from ground zero.
I agree with that, but is there any reason we can't make the information public?
Oh,
broadly?
No.
Yeah, okay.
Absolutely, right.
The online discussions are already public.
Right.
Charlie has created.
So we'd show your summaries as well. And
yeah,
Richard.
Is quite a discrepancy between impressions and reality, and that is striking to me. Yeah, acting upon in a situation in which people do not understand. The second thing is the internet and online comments. They're really intense on both sides. You know, so
yeah.
this isn't something where you find a compromise, you know, or an easy way forward. Third thing is, 80% of the community over 80% did not respond. So if we say those who did not respond, and my guess is they're less intense, they're not all of them, but probably the really intense people got on there and they wrote the comments, and that's the reason you have it. So if they're not intense, I'm really reluctant to move towards a ban, just because I do not see the accuracy of the impressions to begin with. I don't see the response rate. And I see this intense opposition. And I kind of think that, you know, we want it to work, and we want people to be 15 feet away or something. And you want them to obey that naturally. I buy that. But I think the survey came out with the results that.
I'm going to cut off the discussion, because we are going to adjourn in 13 minutes, and we need to hear from the campus judicial code as well. But we will release the data now, and then we'll continue this discussion. We'll try to work with your committee to make a committee to continue the discussion and come back to you. We're not making any further decisions anytime soon. But With that, Richard.
Yes, so
CJC.
So you have an update from Logan in your packet, but there's an update to the update, so I'll pass that around. Whoever. It's very minor change, just a change from the packet. And of course, we would have, I think we were in a position to finish our draft yesterday, but as you know, we lost that day. We were going to have a 3-hour meeting, and it was the last part, the last section of the draft we were going to go over. So we're arranging to meet on Monday, again a 3-hour meeting, in which we will finish this stuff. There are loose ends. For example, we've been trying to get from Keith Barton and the administration what the regulations are on posters and outside displays. And I started trying to get that information 5 weeks ago and kept dunning it, and it finally arrived in my inbox today, but it's not in a form. I'm gonna have to spend the weekend trying to figure out what it is. They're basically messages from different parts of the university, no one of which has a policy that we can figure out. We're trying to figure out the relationship between outdoor structures and posters and freedom of speech, because that belongs in the code. And the problem is, there isn't a policy. There is a bunch of regulations and basically ad hoc decisions, none of which. So we're going to have to spend the weekend doing this. They're going to be loose ends like that, just because coordinating the campus code means coordinating throughout the university different bits and pieces. And so the draft we will circulate for public comment and so forth. It'll still be a work in progress. It's got to be, because we're just we don't have all the information we want. One of the important things that we decided last week, not going to be very many issues like this, but the one issue we decided to put forward to the community for public comment was whether to bring fraternities and sororities under the code. And we have some ideas about how to do that. They're certainly not fixed. They certainly would take some time to implement and probably be in the procedure section that we would take up next semester. But we do want comments on it because we want to know what community is about. That's really it. We are in, I think Chris is right. We are within this one meeting, which is hopefully we can get a quorum because it's the last, turning into pumpkins. but if we can get a quorum, this 3-hour meeting, we should have a draft by next Monday.
May I ask a point of clarification? Martha Pollack has sent a series of emails back and forth to Logan and I today asking when she will be able to get it, because she's been asked by the trustees when she will get it. And she specifically, Logan responded that the first part would be available to the president by Monday and that the procedures might be available then as well. But what I just heard you say is something else.
No, that I haven't been privy to direct participation between Logan and Martha. But when Martha was here, she did say that the first part, the values and the prohibitions, that part she wanted done this semester, and procedures could be next semester.
Okay.
That's my understanding. The procedures section, that, it's going to be equally hard. It's equally difficult. One of the things, the University Council did a really good job in streamlining, cutting away a lot of stuff, and giving us a draft to work with. Unlike Carolyn Levine, their facility with the English language is not very good. So much of what we have spent, much of the time, has been straightening out language
and then going back and seeing what they took out of the original code and figuring out whether we can safely leave those parts out, and so forth and so on. We've really reworked it. They did us a real service in making, giving us a draft to work with. I don't want to begrudge that at all. That would be really good. But we have really, really substantially changed. So we hope, that is our hope, that Martha's draft that we sent Monday, there may be some things like the numbering isn't consistent and so forth, because a lot of that has to wait to the very last minute, and we can't do that in the meeting. That'll be the cosmetic part. But yeah, we'll have a draft.
Comments, questions?
We look forward to seeing what we get next week.
Yeah, me too. Not the least.
Is there any timeline when you think, I mean, at some point the UA has to discuss and vote on this as well. Is there some timeline for the...
What we're hoping, and I think, let me ask this. We have a draft done Monday. We would like to post it for public comment at the same time we give it to the UA, at the same time we're giving it to Martha. I mean, as I think we said the last meeting in the UA, we would like to be getting comments from all directions at once so that we're not serially revising the code in response to different audiences, but instead we're bringing them together. And we'd like to do that before the break so people have the break to look at it, just weeks to look at it if they want, you know, to spend time with it. We haven't had many really intense disagreements. Gavin and Joe can tell us whether I'm misrepresenting this, but I think our longest discussion was merely on whether provisionally to include fraternities and sororities or not. Most of the other stuff has been fairly consensual. I don't think we've had maybe one or two votes where we've had disagreements, you know, some disagreements. But it is technical stuff. We want to get it right. And getting the language right so that you can both understand it and it's the right thing to do. It's taken a lot of work.
I appreciate it. It's a huge amount of work. From my standpoint, I certainly favor making whatever documents as widely publicly available as possible, as soon as possible. So I have no problem with that whatsoever. I would restate how you phrased it a little bit, though. You said to the administration, to the public, and to the UAs, your committee would take in comments from all of those. In the end, it has to come back to this group for debate and approval, and so that we do have a different role than the other system.
Well, of course. No, it can't be submitted to the university without going through the UA. That's absolutely.
Yeah.
This is only to
draft, yeah.
To get comments and to head off some of the, you know, people really running into things we did not think about. And I think the university council's look at this would be, you know, really important.
Yeah, no, I totally agree, and I think public input is important.
You want to do that before we come through here and send it up and it gets rejected. You know, we want to do it in the right order. Yeah, the coordination problem is important. I think it's a good job. But the pieces all are there in such a way that we can tinker with them. Without totally changing the framework. I think the framework is solid. But that may be just because I'm really tired.
We have a few more minutes. I will end at 6. Any other comments or questions on this thing? Chris.
Yeah, Richard, do you, as someone who's been participating in the CJC for a long time, do you feel good about where you are?
Yeah, I do. I do feel good. One of the things I did, you know, I was on the CJC for 2 years and nothing happened. And we were, I won't go through why, but nothing happened. And I was really disappointed last spring. I'd wasted a lot of time. And I was, at that point, I was really ready to give up, you know, just not do it. But when Logan volunteered to do it, and I said, well, okay, you know, it's like sunk cost, right? You sunk those 2 years, you'll spend more money, you'll do it in another year. So I went and joined up on it. One of the things this year I've realized is just how much you learn about the university when you're considering the code. It's not, you know, how the universe, you want the code to be a declaration, basically an implementation of the declaration of values in the community. You want that part to be there. You don't want it to be all prohibitions and police and stuff. But you also need the prohibitions because they're rights. And the rights, the articulation of rights, really becomes this realization of values in the community. And you're constantly balancing those. And it really is complicated. You know, the things, the dealing with meetings, lectures, where invited people, lectures. You know, one of the issues that came up was whether or not the university should be regulating the recognition of questions and questioners at a public meeting, so that the public meeting, that the organizers and so on, were not discriminating against certain people. And that was really balancing two different, very different notions of freedom of speech. The organization itself and sponsoring an event in which it wanted to make its case, and the rights of the community to ask questions of the speaker. That, those are two very different conceptions of freedom of speech and rights. And saying, yes, I mean, I feel good about where we have. I also feel, you know, like some of these issues are never going to go away.
It is 6 o'clock, so we will adjourn. Thank you all for all you've been doing and hard work today. We're not meeting again until next month, so happy holidays, everyone.
Oh, that's true.
And at our next meeting next month, the provost will be here, and Martha Pollack will be at our second meeting in February.
Thank you, everyone.
This has been a production of Cornell University. On the web at cornell.edu.